Welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. Oh, folks, we're a few days removed from the PGA Championship. And Rex, I live about 15 minutes from TPC Sawgrass, where Aaron Rye and his lovely wife live. I've not been notified of any plans for a parade, a celebration, any sort of flyover to celebrate Aaron Rye, the newest PGA champion. How is your post-PGA Championship hangover coming along?
Outside of yesterday's Golf Today, and you and I were just kicking it up about, it was 25 minutes of unscripted TV. Normally, you and I are pretty good at that. These podcasts are nothing if not unscripted. However, when you're dealing with a conspiracy theorist, that is Eamon Lynch, it was a bit of keep you on your toes moment. I think both of us will attest to that. However, I'm glad that the four of us on that roundtable, and certainly you and I on Sunday night for the Monday morning pod, all came to the same conclusion that Aaron Rye was a good winner. He was a great story to write from a storytelling point of view. If you looked at what that golf course was asking of you, it was asking you to hit fairways and asking you to make putts. And that's really what Aaron Rye did. And he did it better than anyone else for the week, I would argue. And also, I don't want to revisit this. I think what Aronimink was as a golf course, as a major championship test, was refreshing in my mind. It wasn't your normal ball striking contest that we see pretty much at every major championship, either off the tee or from the fairway or a combination of those two things. It asked a very specific question that doesn't get asked very much in major championship golf. So I think everything about it has been fun. The best part, though, is the world kind of getting to know Aaron Rye a little bit better, because Rory McIlroy said it best, that there was no one on property that wasn't happy that he won.
Yeah, I said it yesterday on the roundtable. Aaron Rye is such a humble, polite, hardworking player on the PGA Tour that it's a refreshing antidote to what we've seen and sort of the culture that's been rampant on the PGA Tour over the past couple of years, which is selfishness and greed. And I mean, Rory McIlroy said it best: you won't find a single person on property who is not happy for Aaron Rye. I looked all over property on Sunday evening, and there was plenty of anecdotes about just how great of a guy, just how hardworking he is. Everybody and anyone is happy for Aaron Rye. I do feel like people were sleeping on his finish, though, Rex. Like, the shots that he hit on 9, 11, 13, the bunker shot when he was greenside there, 16, obviously the putt on 17. If those had been hit by anyone else, if those had been hit by Scottie Scheffler, Roy McIlroy, Xander Schauffele, Jon Rahm, Ludvig Åberg, like, instantly we'd be talking about one of the best finishes in a major championship in recent memory. A player going 6 under over his final 10 holes to essentially steal a major championship that at that point was wide open. It looks like 6 or 7 different players could emerge from the pack to win the year's second major. Instead, because it's Aaron Rye, because he'd only won once previously on the PGA Tour, because he is a little bit quiet, a little bit soft-spoken, a little bit methodical and plodding in his approach, it just feels like people are sleeping on it. But when you actually look at the shot quality and what he was able to pull off over the last 10 holes, it was extraordinary golf. Not just tee shots, approach shots, around the green, putting. I mean, it was all there on display over those final 10 holes.
And you have to give him style points as well. It's not as though he was alone at the top of that leaderboard. You had some of the best players in the game coming after him. I mean, you had Xander Schauffele right there. You had Jon Rahm right there. You had Rory McIlroy until his last 2 or 3 holes right there. The best players in the game were right behind him. And if he was going to blink, you would anticipate it would have come on the back nine. It would have come with those difficult shots. I think you talked to his caddy about how difficult that bunker shot was, that he'd never really seen him do that before. That was interesting, that in the most tense moment, he was able to step
he pulled off a shot he had either never tried before or never successfully completed before, and said skies it up to the back ledge and over the green was going to be dead. From that position, it looks very likely when you're a greenside, he could potentially be walking off with bogey. Instead, pulls it off, hits it to 7 feet, and makes the putt. At that point, it was his tournament to lose.
I feel like that's the definition of clutch. Here's something that you haven't done 1,000 times under the most intense pressure you faced your entire life. And, oh, I'm just going to pull it off flawlessly. I'll go back to Matt Fitzpatrick at the Zurich Classic a few weeks ago, setting up that final putt for his brother from that bunker. It's clear that Matt had hit that shot plenty of times in practice. He had way too much swagger to think that, no, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. The way he stepped into it, the reaction after he hit it, he'd done that before. Don't want to take anything away from it. But in this particular case, Aaron Rye was probably flying blind on some respects. And you touched on two things. One, the idea that he is very quiet, that there was no fist bumping, there was no celebrations, there were no high fives. You could tell it was all business. And that's what I think you would come to expect from someone like Aaron Rye, all the stories that we've heard about him. I also go to the idea that he touched on this a couple of times. Like, here is a guy that truly just loves the journey. He loves the work. He loves being on the range. He loves trying to figure out a way to play the game. This is not a guy that's surrounded by an entourage on a PGA Tour range when he shows up. He's literally trying to grind it out of the dirt by himself. His dad taught him the game. Dad didn't know how to play the game. Did it from a book. So you talk about players being self-made. I don't know we could come up with a better scenario. Here is a truly self-made, world-class major championship player.
And look, I know a million people, Rex, read our newsletter, and that's not a lie. There's a million people in our database. I encourage everyone to go to golfshow.com/Rex and Lav to get involved. We're going to have a major championship newsletter at the U.S. Open and the Open Championship as well. But I tried to touch on that this PGA Championship victory was really a tribute to a player who has always done it his own way. And I think early in his career, it would be easy to poke fun at some of the things that Aaron Rye does or wears or just gives.
Two gloves.
He's got the two gloves. Irons. He's got iron covers. He uses castle tees. Like, these are things that you would expect from, I don't know, a 12-year-old, but not necessarily a 31-year-old winner on the PGA Tour. But the reasons why he does it, I think, are certainly touching and heartwarming as a tribute to his parents to never forget where he came from. But also, Rex, it shows me that this is a player who is unafraid of doing it his own way and sticks with what he knows works. And that has been evident ever since he began the game when he was the age of four. His parents keeping him out of sort of elite junior competition so he would just practice on his own. I loved this idea of playing, what did he call it, like a protracted course length where you continually play longer distances and longer tees as you age out, basically essentially trying to get players to either break par or shoot around par before you essentially make the golf course longer for you. I've got a 7-year-old son of myself. That's a great way for him to build some confidence and learn how to score as well. A player who turned pro at the age of 17, needing to have the confidence, needing to have the belief, needing to have the conviction that he was on the right track at that point, to see it pay off 14 years later. Is I think a great tribute to him as a player, and it shows that he has full faith in his abilities in a game that's increasingly disparate from those skills. I mean, he's one of the shortest hitters on the PGA Tour. He's not particularly accurate with his approach play, at least heading into the PGA Championship.
He had
struggled on and around the greens as well. But for him to able to carve out a nice career. Now 15th in the world ranking, exempt on the PGA Tour for 5 years, exempt from the major championships for 5 years. A great, great story in Aaron Rye. As a peek behind the curtain, Rex, I handle all of our audio recording. I upload it onto all of the audio platforms, whether it's iTunes or Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcast. I write all the headlines for the podcast as well. And I put that this championship was polarizing. It was a polarizing event, and I couldn't help but go through the YouTube comment section on Monday morning when the pod uploaded there, and one of the commenters said, "How could this tournament be polarizing? Like, this just sucked. Like, there's nothing polarizing about it." That was the only comment. Everything else was either, "This was awesome," "This was terrible," "I'm happy for Aaron Rye," or "This was boring." This was a polarizing
definition of polarizing. Yeah.
Do you think that's largely because of the winner, or do you think that's how we got to that point where it was a really logjam, confusing, confounding, upside-down leaderboard that didn't shake out until late on Sunday?
I don't believe it can be about the winner, because if you just took a second to learn all of the things that you just rattled off about Aaron Rye, you would be hard-pressed to come up with a reason not to like him. And I think it's kind of comical that someone would be like, "Oh, no, it's a no-name winner." Well, we end up with that. I mean, that happens. You have plenty. You have to win.
JJ Spahn, in some respects, was very similar.
He was a journeyman. I mean, you can go back over the history. The PGA Championship is where it seems to happen more times than not when you talk about the Sean McKeel and the Rich Beams of the world. However, that doesn't mean they weren't worthy champions. But I think you go to the heart of why I think it was polarizing. There was so much talk about the golf course. I think yesterday during the round table, when you were asked what stood out from you from the week, you said the golf course, and you never go back to the golf course. It's always about a personality. It's all about a performance. It's all about a player that you focused on over the course of the week. And maybe that's why I think it was it almost on some level became a distraction, because you had so many players with so many different opinions of it, and they swung. It went from, this is hard, this is almost over the top, these greens are almost unfair, to, oh, it's too easy, it's not a good major championship test, all based entirely on what Kerry Haig did with this setup. And I think this is a testament to the golf course, that Kerry Haig probably could have continued to tuck those pins and 3, 4, 5 under would have won. I would argue 10 years from now, when we're talking about this PGA championship, we're probably just going to look at the score, look at the winners, look at who was near the lead, look at who had a chance to win, and be like, yeah, that seems like it was a pretty good one. Whatever happens with Aaron Rye's career, you still had world-class players around him. So, okay, maybe you don't like the idea of the 44th-ranked player in the world, and that's what Aaron Rye was coming into the week. It's not as though he was way down the list. It's not as though he was a virtual unknown on this front. Maybe you had a player that wasn't on many people's radar, but it was a packed leaderboard. It was pretty close until about halfway through the final nine on Sunday. I think all of those things are a testament to it was a good golf course. That, yeah, there was probably a lot to talk about. There was probably a lot of question marks about it, but I don't think you can argue with the outcome.
Yeah, I certainly love the outcome. I don't know that I necessarily liked the process to get there. And as I try to think why fans found this championship to be polarizing, I think that fans generally like to see the best players in the world tested. I think everyone is bored by 20, 25, 30 under par winning golf tournaments. However, players being tested doesn't necessarily have to equate to higher scoring. And by that, I mean, there's a difference between good pars that are built on scrambling and that are built on clutchness and that are built on getting out of position and sort of working out a score that way. And pars that I thought we saw, at least over the first 3 days of the PGA Championship, that were essentially manufactured by the setup that forced everyone into the same area. And some people took exception with me saying that long putting is fluky. The actual skill of lag putting is a skill. Three putt avoidance, approach putt performance, being able to closely lag a putt from long distance, 40, 50 feet, that is a skill. Actually making those putts from 30, 40, or 50 feet, I don't know what to tell you. It is fluky. That's why the make percentages on the PGA Tour are between 1% to 5% from those ranges. It's fluky when you make them. It's happenstance. It's a little bit of luck. Again, lag putting a skill, making those putts is actually fluky. And so that's what I think you saw over the first three rounds in particular. I think Sunday was a completely different story. And it sort of bears out with the scoring averages as well in some of the good rounds. You had the round from Kurt Kitayama shooting 63 very, very early. You had the round from 65 from Justin Thomas. And about the middle of the day, was able to post a number, waited around the clubhouse to see if it was going to stand up. It eventually didn't. Aaron Rye's 65 that he eventually shot, and again, he went 6 under over his final 10 holes. That was the best score and round of the day by miles over the past couple hours of the tournament. Why? Because it was 90 degrees, the golf course firmed up, and there was finally an emphasis and importance placed on precision. He was tied for second in driving accuracy that day. He put the ball in the position that he needed to into the greens, and he was able to make the putts when he needed to as well. It was built on lag putting. It was built on precision. That was finally a separation of skills as opposed to over the first 54 holes where it was very bunched. You had short and inaccurate hitters who were ruling the day and staying on top of the leaderboard. Had that been any other setup, Rex, like an Alex Smalley, a Cam Smith would have been nowhere near the top of the leaderboard unless they had like a world-class out-of-body experience on and around the greens. Instead, because of the setup, at least over the first 54 holes, they were able to hang around.
If you'd have told me at the beginning of this podcast one of us was going to be defending a take, I wouldn't have thought it was yours. I didn't realize that you were so thin-skinned on this one. I thought for sure I was going to be the one defending takes.
It's not thin-skinnedness. It's it's defending something that I believe. And I think it bears out in the scoring average. Like the scoring average over the first couple rounds was 72 and change. Keep in mind, Rex, that's with 20 club professionals and I don't know, a dozen or so players who are well past their prime and should not be playing if not for their past champion status. 72 and change is not very high for a par 70 golf course where you're throwing a lot of wedges in there. Again, there was just very little separation in scoring. And I think that's why this tournament felt so unorthodox. It felt so unusual. It felt so clumsy, at least until the final couple hours.
Well, and I would argue, listening to the comments that you've made, I haven't looked at the comments underneath at Monday's podcast, but that's polarizing by definition. If somebody loves it and somebody hates it, I think that's correct. Probably the best case scenario.
In other words, I nailed the headline.
Yeah, I don't think calling it polarizing is outside the window. I think where most people are going to get caught up, and I think we touched on this a couple of times throughout the course of the week, it felt like the golf course setup, at least on Thursday and Friday, dumbed down the ball striking element of this. It felt like the best players in the world, which are the best ball strikers in the world by and large, their advantage, the one thing they do better than everyone else, was mitigated by this golf course setup. Rory McIlroy talked about this. The idea coming in that he felt like he could bomb it off every tee and just wedge it into the greens. He quickly learned, oh, that's not the case at all. This is a different test. I keep going back to that. And I can see why some people get hung up on it, that maybe this isn't the test that you want to see in a major championship, because this isn't what we normally see by and large at major championships. I didn't have a problem with it because, one, it's just a different version of golf. Like, every element of the game is important. You calling that fluky, I did get caught up on as well, because all of those things you pointed out are very much skills.
It is fluky.
There's a reason. Well, yes, it's fluky to make 30 footers, but it's not fluky. All of those stats you pointed out, there's a reason why the PGA Tour tracks approach putt performance, three putt performance. All of those things are important on golf courses like this. Augusta National's the same way. We call it a second shot golf course. Sometimes I argue it's a lag putting contest because you're never going to get close to some of those pins. You're essentially just playing to a bowl and trying to get the best angle possible, not to three putt from wherever it is you are. I can get why people get caught up on this particular golf course. You and I both said the same thing. It's a fun golf course. I'd love to go back and play it from the members' tees and mow down the rough a little bit. It looks like a blast. And not only is, I think, the quality of the champion, as you pointed out, all of the things that Aaron Wright did, not even over the course of the week, but really over that last hour of play where you had to execute shots under the most intense pressure, and the variety of the leaderboard. I mean, is that not what we want? We want a variety of players on top of the leaderboard. As I pointed out, it was Xander Schauffele. It was John Rahm. It was Rory McIlroy. Scottie Scheffler even could have made a run there somewhere in the mix. And you had your Aaron Ries mixed in and your Alex Smalley's and all of these other players. I think that made it entertaining to me.
Yes, you should be able to arrive at the same score differently. That's not something that I want to discount. It's the setup that intentionally and purposefully bunched the scores over the first couple of days. It was the issue that I had with the setup at the PGA Championship. The fact that you had 10 pins on the opening round that were six or fewer paces from the edge of the green, 9 pins on Friday were six or fewer paces from the green. It wasn't just the fact that it was basically on the edge of the green, Rex. It was on slopes. It was on shelves. They were hard to access. PGA of America, in my opinion, was far too protective of the setup. This easily could have gotten 14, 15, 16 under par, would have been a more interesting golf tournament, would have been a better golf tournament, in my opinion. Speaking of takes that you'd like to take back, you certainly got absolutely destroyed for your take that major championship golf should never go back to places like Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. There were reports on Monday morning of the mayor waiting for you outside your gate. There were rioters picketing, saying death to Hoggard. Is there anything that you would like to clean up, elaborate on? I don't even know. Apologize for, based on your prior comments.
I would just assume not continue this conversation because I'm kind of tired of this conversation. But a couple of things, since you're going to press me on it. And yes, it was not a popular take. First things first, I have nothing against Newtown Square. It's actually a beautiful little town. We made a mention of it. I was in the car with Brandel Chambly and Rich Lerner. An absolutely beautiful little suburb. And I was totally wrong on the population. It's 15,000 plushes. So it wasn't 2,000. It's not that small. And in proximity to Philadelphia, I think it's 10 miles maybe to the city center. So yes, all of those points are valid. Please stop adding me and making these arguments. I understand that. This goes to the idea of, and also the people who pointed out that the new Yankee Stadium actually holds fewer seats than the old Yankee Stadium. Thank you for that as well. I appreciate the clarification on that. My comeback to that is, well, the parking is better at new Yankee Stadium. The seats are better. The bathrooms are better. The refreshments are better. I'm sure it costs more. Yeah. It costs more. That goes to my point. When I spoke with Kerry Hague about this 2 weeks ago or before the championship, they gave out, they sold about 10,000 fewer tickets for Aronimink PGA than they would have for a normal PGA the year before. Quail Hollow, take that as an example. And it's specifically because of the smaller footprint. Kerry Hague told me that's his words, not mine. So that's already lost income off the top. This is a bottom line conversation. And if you don't like the bottom line conversation, then yes, I get why you're angry at me. I have nothing against Newtown Square or Aronimink. I, as we just said, love this particular golf course. From a business perspective, it doesn't make sense because you're already losing money on this PGA Championship. And as we talked about yesterday on the Golf Today Roundtable, purse went up $20.5 million. So you're losing money. You're paying the players more.
Is that sustainable, Rex? Is that sustainable, Eamon Lynch?
It is not sustainable. That's a whole different conversation. All right? You haven't renegotiated the TV deals with CBS or ESPN, so you're not bringing in more money on that front. So essentially, all of the money that you would have taken to give to programs like PGA Hope or any of the programs that the 30,000 PGA of America members count on now goes into the purse. The money you've lost plus the additional purse money. This is a conversation about spreadsheets. I know it's boring. This is about where you should take a major sporting event. If you have to sell 10,000 fewer tickets over the course of the week, that's going to impact your bottom line. That doesn't make sense from a business perspective. There's a reason why the Masters is the best spectator event in all of golf, because they've had decades to perfect this. You and I both know what they've done there is amazing, and they just get better every single year. There's a reason why the USGA has named Pinehurst, Pebble Beach, and Oakmont anchor sites. And every year we go back to one of those sites, you see something more. The infrastructure gets better year in and year out, because that's what you need for a major sporting event. And these organizations like the USGA, the PGA of America, and the RNA, they need this revenue, not just to pay the players the purse. This is about the things they do from a program perspective. And if you don't have that money, those programs are going to suffer. In this particular case, those programs are going to suffer. It's a bottom line conversation. Again, nothing against Newtown Square. Beautiful place.
Hey, I didn't say anything about Newtown Square. You said something about Newtown
Again,
Square.
Again, it's all right. It's 10 miles from Philadelphia, city center. There's plenty of Fortune 500 companies. That's not what this conversation is about. It's about the small footprint that is Aronimink. Great golf course, too small of a footprint for a major championship event.
We're going to have a small footprint as well, as you pointed out, next month at Shinnecock, which also is one of those anchor sites. And to your point, where I think you are valid, Rex, there's the point of making those anchor sites for the USGA. It's not being lazy. It's not trying to map out your calendar until 2060. It's trying to get the infrastructure in place. And so it's a rinse and repeat every 5, 6, 7 years. It helps mitigate some of the costs. It helps mitigate some of the lost revenue, because you do have a smaller footprint. You are going to have fewer fans on site. It is going to be a little bit of a logistical nightmare going in and out from Long Island with the two-lane road to get to the golf course. Again, that's the purpose of the USGA and why they're setting out these anchor sites. I'm assuming it's going to be a topic of conversation again next month as well. As we did look forward to the US Open, Rex, just to sort of put a bow on this conversation, I was looking more forward to the golf course than any of the player storylines. And obviously, we're going to get to Scottie Scheffler and his pursuit of the career Grand Slam. I'm very interested in seeing the golf course. Keep in mind, Shinnecock back in 2018 when Brooks Koepka won, that was the last time we had an over par winning score in a major championship. Almost got there last year at Oakmont before JJ Spaun went nuclear on the 71st and 72nd holes of the golf tournament to finish under par. I can't wait to see, because unlike the PGA of America, I don't think the USGA has to be protective in its setup on this golf course. They clearly learned from the lessons from 2018. None of those setup staff are still in place here in 2026. The golf course alone should be able to shine and should be able to produce a winner in the low single digits or even over par if the wind and the conditions allow for it.
I'm gladly going to take my CFO curmudgeon hat off for this conversation, because as Eamon Lynch, our colleague, pointed out yesterday, that Shinnecock Hills may not be the best golf course in the neighborhood. Forget about in that area. Forget about in that zip code. If you look at National Golf Links, which is right next door, it's a phenomenal course as well. The golf nerds are going to love every bit of this. And yes, it's going to be logistically difficult just because of where it's located way out on Long Island. But this is an anchor site for all the right reasons. You're right. They work on the infrastructure every single year to get better when the U.S. Open comes back. But it's also, this is, in my opinion, one of the true cathedrals of golf. This is one of those places where if you're going to do a bucket list of these are the places I want to watch the best players play golf, Shinnecock Hills is going to be on that list. And you're right. I think from a setup perspective, the USGA has been there enough. They know what to expect. They don't have to trick it up. We won't be having these conversations about pins being six paces off the edge of the green, which, by the way, six paces, if you look at most tour events, if you want to talk about tuck pins, that's three paces. I think that's an indication of how difficult those greens were at Aronimink. That six paces seems like
A lot of the paces at the PGA Championship setup were still three or four, but just as a sort of a general rule of thumb, six paces, 18 feet, that's really tucked. You see it all the time on the PGA Tour. Those are not at this speed. They're certainly not at this undulation slope and ridges as well.
And you're right. The people at the USGA who probably stumbled in the past at Shinnecock Hills are no longer there. I think Hello, Mike Davis. I think the idea is just let this golf course, a lot like they do during the Open Championship, you're going to get whatever Mother Nature hands to you, and let the golf course be center stage. That's the beauty of these types of venues. And you have a handful of them in the United States. You have Pinehurst, you have Pebble Beach, you have Shinnecock, you have Oakmont that we saw last year that can always stand up to the best players in the world. They don't have to be tricked up.
The headliner at the U.S. Open, Rex, is obviously going to be Scottie Scheffler, who, as I mentioned, will be going for the final leg of the career Grand Slam. He is in the field this week at the CJ Cup. Byron Nelson, coming off a week at the PGA Championship in which he finished outside the top 10 in a major for the first time in seven major starts. Where's your level of concern as it relates to Scottie Scheffler, and sort of what are your expectations looking at him this week? Obviously, this was the site, the Byron Nelson last year, where he ripped off an 8-shot win and kicked off a pretty torrid summer.
Yeah, we went back to that stat last week at the PGA Championship going into that we ran on live from, I think, on Tuesday or Wednesday night, that he's essentially at the exact same spot he was last season. One win, bunch of top five finishes, scoring average right about the same, and this is where he really got on that run on his way to winning player of the year and major championships and everything else he was able to win. I said this yesterday on the Golf Today roundtable. There's nothing wrong with Scottie Scheffler that getting away from Aronimink probably isn't going to help, because clearly that wasn't his brand of vodka. He did not particularly like those greens, and if you're a player that really likes to grind it out, that is so exacting with his iron play, I can imagine why that particular golf course was a little aggravating to you. You're right. Going back to the Nelson is probably going to be a breath of fresh air. It's a home game. It's something he looked forward to. It does set up an interesting scenario going forward. And this is, I'm shocked that Eamon Lynch didn't ask us about this, because there's a chance that the Nelson or Colonial or a combination of the two are track two events. I'm not saying they are or they aren't. We have no idea what the 14 to 18 track one events are going to be on the PGA Tour schedule going forward. I would imagine one of them is a track one event. But if not, there's a chance where you have a Scottie Scheffler, the world number one. Jordan Spieth is probably in that category. All of those guys that call Dallas home are going to want to play in these events. And this is a topic of conversation internally on the PGA Tour. If you're Scottie Scheffler, you probably are going to want to play the Nelson and maybe even Colonial, which is fine. You can go down and play track two events if that's where they're going to land. But there's also a scenario where there would be a track one event head-to-head with this, because there's only so many weeks over the course of this condensed season. So it's going to be interesting to see how the schedule plays out, because this is a really good example of how each player has their own fifth major. We can have the conversation about the Players' Championship, but every player, depending on where you're from, where you grew up, what golf courses you like, has an event that's sort of outside the box that they love to play in. In this particular case, it's the Nelson. And he's going to want to play there regardless, and it's going to be interesting to see how the tour handles those situations.
Yeah, put a pin in that, because I want to get into this SBJ report here in a second. I'd be shocked if Colonial was not a track one event. I mean, if
I think one of
to,
them will be, I don't know if both of them will be. Yeah, that's my point.
I can't imagine the Nelson is, even though they did just dump $25 million right into the renovation for TPC Craig Ranch. Remember, Scottie Scheffler tore it up last year at 31 under par. I think everyone is curious to see if it's going to be providing a more stout test this time around. I think you got the Scottie Scheffler question yesterday during the roundtable. I think concern is relative as it relates to Scottie. Like, do you have concern that he's not going to win 6 to 8 times in 2026? Yeah, I think that's a legitimate concern. Is he still a threat to win a major championship? Is he still a threat to win 2 to 4 more times throughout the course of the season? Absolutely. You look at what he is doing statistically, it is inarguable that he has fallen off in some statistical categories year over year. He's about a half shot worse as it relates to strokes gained total, almost all of which is coming from his approach play. Again, his proximity to the hole is still outside the top 100 on the PGA Tour. We have a large enough sample size to know now, Rex, that he's just not quite as sharp with what is typically his best weapon. What dogged him at the PGA Championship, however, was his putting, which has actually not been a weakness so far in the 2026 season. The make percentage from 4 to 8 feet at the PGA Championship was about 45%. That puts it on par, if not worse, than some of the most difficult putting that you see on the PGA Tour throughout the course of the year, whether Pebble Beach or Riviera, which typically inflates some of those strokes gained putting numbers. So Scottie was not the only player who struggled inside 10 feet, and obviously he missed 14 of them, and that was the main reason why he did not win the PGA Championship, whereas Aaron Rye missed just 4 times inside 10 feet. And so putting, I don't think it is a concern. Shinnecock obviously is going to present a similar difficulty on the greens in terms of the slope, in terms of the speed. I have little doubt that he and Phil Kenyon, his swing coach, his putting coach, will figure it out over the next couple of weeks. You mentioned sort of the track one, track two. Our friend Josh Carpenter, Sports Business Journal, reported on Tuesday coming out of the player meeting at the Truist Championship, where this was presented. Looks like, Rex, a 23-event schedule when you're looking at track-elite players. In that is going to be 16 Tier 1 events, 4 major championships, and the 3 playoff events, all at about a $30 million purse. Josh Carpenter also reported that they're looking at new markets, Seattle, San Francisco, Boston, Philly, Denver, Nashville. On its face, seems like some pretty good changes. Obviously, the details, though, are going to be what's important here, particularly the cadence.
Yeah, I think the details are interesting. As we get closer to the Travelers Championship, that's the soft deadline that Brian Rollout, the CEO of the PGA Tour, set. The idea that he wants to have something he can roll out then. Because, as we've talked about, he needs to roll it out sooner rather than later. This is all about getting the new product to market for these TV deals. And if he can get something like that on paper and take it to the TV executives early, and we're talking about by the end of the summer, I think that benefits the tour, because essentially the tour is in a race with Major League Baseball. Who's going to get their share of that media pie going down the stretch? That's what this is all about. And this is pretty much what we've talked about for a while. The idea that there's going to be somewhere around 2021 events, counting the playoff events, counting the major championships. I guess where the questions start to land is, you want to go back to major markets. You want to be in Chicago. You want to be in Seattle, these places they talked about. Are these existing events? I mean, we've had the conversation. Does the John Deere just relocate from where they are in Illinois to Chicago? I guess that's an option. Do you create new events? There's still some things that I have pretty major questions about. Also, the window is going to be interesting here. As we have seen over the last really 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, the top players in the world aren't going to play that many events in a row. So whatever this schedule is going to look like, Rollap and the policy board are going to have to come up with a way that fits their schedules. That means that you're not going to make them play 5 weeks in a row with 2 majors or a major and the Players' Championship wedged in there. You have to have built-in off weeks. So when you look at the window, when you look at the calendar, there's not a lot of wiggle room based on probably where they want to start. So I'm curious about that as well.
Especially when you're trying to, quote-unquote, start big. That would be in January, and that would be up against the NFL season. Obviously, you want to end in August, as the playoffs traditionally have over the past couple of years, preempting football season starting as well. I'm very curious to see the new venues, if we can get to that point, not just the markets, but the venues as well. A lot of talk about Sahali being back on the schedule. God, I'd love to see Chambers Bay, which I thought got the short end of the stick of the 2015 the U.S. Open with some of the setup there. San Francisco, TPC Harding Park would make a lot of sense. Boston, plenty of golf courses you go to. God, I'd love to see the Country Club as well. More likely we get TPC Boston back in our lives, which I didn't necessarily hate either. Philadelphia could see a Ronimink potentially be. I think it certainly makes sense as a regular PGA Tour stop. I really enjoyed Philly Cricket Club a year ago as well, even if the setup there was a little bit wonky. Cherry Hills, if you're going to Denver, just hosted the BMW Championship a couple years ago. Nashville, I'm not so sure about, Rex. I'm not completely familiar with some of the high-level golf courses in and around that area. Maybe the Golf Club of Tennessee might make the most sense, but I think that's going to be an interesting discussion as well. If you're a top-level PGA Tour player, you want to go to the best golf courses that you can play, the best venues. And if you're the PGA Tour, just as I mentioned with Colonial, you need to lean into what you do best, and that is those golf courses, either iconic golf courses or the best test for the top players. The cadence of Track 2, I think, also bears watching as well. Do you run them concurrently to Track 1 events? Do you separate them? How do you then signal to viewers if it's during the typical golf season that these events are going to matter too? I think it's a whole interesting conversation that, again, we don't have much details about, but hopefully in about a month's time when you and I are both at TPC River Highlands, that we do. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be back on Sunday night for a recap of the Byron Nelson, anything else that happens out in the world of golf. If you want to be a part of the Sunday night show, you guys know what to do. Find us in the YouTube comment section. We will do a voices in the crowd section. We'll also probably, Rex, do a love it or lav it. We'll have all sorts of fun with the segments on what could be potentially a light news week. All right,
boots on the ground.
Oh, we could do a boots on the ground. Who's on the ground this week?
Amy Rogers.
Oh, Amy Rogers. Yeah, we'd love to get her on the show. We'll see if we can
be one and effort only
in order to do so. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys on Sunday night. Have a great rest of your golf week.